Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit 1 per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall finally be continuing my story, the narrative of Magellan's fantastic and terrifying voyage around the world. We've had a couple of weeks away from it, so we shall continue it now and hopefully see it through to the end. So if you remember last time, we left off where Magellan and his crew, his ship, his armada of 5 ships, had crossed the Atlantic. And they'd hit the coast of Brazil, and they'd stopped in at Rio de Janeiro, or the place that later became Rio de Janeiro, to outfit, take on new supplies, and meet some of the natives that happened to be extremely friendly, these natives at Rio de Janeiro. So much so that some of the men got a bit carried away with their carnal desires. So I'll let Lawrence Bergreen continue by saying this. After 2 weeks of sensual indulgence, the fleet's departure from Rio de Janeiro on December the 27th became an emotionally charged affair. João Lopes Carvalho, Magellan's pilot, returning to Brazil after a 7-year absence, happily reunited with his former mistress, who introduced him to their son. Carvalho took an immediate liking to the lad, whom he called Joãozito, and enlisted him as a servant aboard ship. Goes on to be said that he also asked for the lady, the Brazilian mistress, to be taken on board as well. But Magellan said no, strictly no women on board. It's bad for morale, apparently, and various other things. And he had all the ships searched for any women's that might have been stowed away below deck. And apparently they found several. So Magellan had them thrown off the ship, and they continued on their way. And apparently a lot of the women folk tried to chase after them in their small canoes, but were obviously outpaced. There's that story. But resuming a southerly course, the fleet, helped by favourable winds, reached Paranagua Bay off the coast of Brazil by the last day of 1519. Intent on making up time, Magellan ordered the ships to remain offshore rather than exploring the bay, one of the largest estuaries in the southwest Atlantic. Fully provisioned, the Armada sailed on day and night until January the 8th, 1520, when Magellan spied a stretch of shoal extending as far as the eye could see. Concerned about hitting a concealed formation, he gave an order to drop anchor, but only for the night. In the morning, the fleet sailed on. On January the 10th, the rolling hills and mountains of the South American coast yielded to barely discernible hummocks and the suggestion of offshore islands. Goes on for a fair bit of description to talk about the coastline there, along the Brazilian coast, because of course the Brazilian coast is extremely long. The long and short of it is, the ultimate point of all of this, is that Magellan's looking for a way through South America. So this is the big thing. At this point in the voyage, Magellan thought, and all his pilots and all the astronomers, all the pilots, that there has to be a way through South America. They didn't even know how far down the continent stretched. As I say, some people might even have joined up with an Antarctic continent. So they assumed that there must be some sort of passage, and this is their golden ticket. This is the thing they think will sort of not only be their ticket through, but it will save their lives, or without it, they're doomed in some way, or at least will have to turn back. Now, spoiler alert, a little bit, anyone who's never looked at a map, spoiler alert. There is a way through, but it's right at the bottom of South America, basically. You can chop off a bit of the voyage by travelling through, and these days it's called the Straits of Magellan, but it's right at the bottom. There is no way through, essentially, the middle, or even two-thirds of the way down. There is no way through. So you do have to go all the way around. nearly all the way around. We'll talk all about the Straits of Magellan when we get to it. But so you can either go through those straits or you can go all the way around the actual tip, the Horn of South America, through what is probably the most treacherous waters in the world. That stretch of water where the Atlantic and the Pacific join up, you know, where it's literally in between Tierra del Fuego and Antarctica. Many people say that is the worst bit of sea, ocean, in the whole world. And again, they didn't know that. And Magellan has sort of promised his men that there is a way through. There must be a way through. I mean, he's convinced that there must be a way through. And it's sort of a bit of wishful thinking because he's got no way of knowing. He didn't know. So it's a bit of optimistic wishful thinking. As I say, they eventually find it, but that's still a long way off in our story. We're then told a little bit all about what it's like to actually live on board and what these men really look like, what the reality of, you know, early 16th century seamanship was like. And these ships are small, you know, they're really quite small. If you look at the Golden Hind, for example, a similar, very similar sort of ship, I think they're tiny. How you can cram like 80 guys on there is remarkable to me, as well as all the provisions they're supposed to need, as well as livestock and all sorts of things. Must have been extremely packed. And the idea that living on board for weeks or even months on end without ever hitting shore again, it would have been a hothouse situation, living cheek to jowl, to put it mildly. So a couple of paragraphs here from Bergreen, who very well describes it very well. He says, quote, 5 months from Seville, the crew and officers had become familiar with the ships, as well as the rigours and deprivations of life at sea. They had learned of the violence of storms, the life and death necessity of sounding the bottom, and the limits of the proud vessels in which they sailed over the surface of the limitless sea. The misery of seasickness was at last behind them. There had been no escape from the ordeal. Even veteran mariners were vulnerable to its pains. According to folk wisdom, sexual activity increased the likelihood of seasickness, but it was a rare sailor who could resist the opportunity for coupling before getting out on a long voyage. At sea, sleep became an ultimate luxury, a solace nearly impossible to come by. The crew took naps whenever they could, night or day. Hammocks had yet to be introduced on board ships, so exhausted sailors appropriated a plank, or better still, a sheltered area on deck where they could sprawl. They eased the wood's bruising hardness with a straw pallet and shielded themselves against the cold and wet with heavy blankets. Even then, comfort eluded them. The men never became accustomed to the foul odours brewing aboard their ships. Oh yeah, these ships stank, absolutely stank. They could be smelt, apparently, when they were offshore. When they were a long way offshore, the people on the land, if the wind was in the right way, could smell them a long way away, absolutely fetid and rank. Water seeping into the hold stank despite the efforts to disinfect it with vinegar. Animals such as cows and pigs added to the reek, as did the slowly rotting food supply and sickening smell of salted fish wafting from the hold. So there's this thing, these ships leaked. They always, always leaked. And apparently there's no way around it. No matter how much pitch you put on the outside, no matter how well constructed they were, there would still be leaks. And eventually you'd have to, even if it was a very small leak, eventually you'd have to bail them out. The bottom of the hold would become water sodden. You have to start bailing it out. And that's in the best case scenario. Most of the time, they're actually leaking a fair bit. And this water, once it's stagnant, once it's in the ship, you know, it goes off, it goes fetid. And the other thing is, and this is even up to the 19th century, whenever these ships were grounded, i.e. actually land on dry land, for when they were having the barnacles scraped off the bottom and for refitting and all that sort of thing, then the mud from any given estuary would also get in, or seawater that's saturated with that mud will get in. And that mud in and of itself stinks, you know, because it's filled with organic, rotting organic material. So it absolutely stinks. And then, as we're told, throw on top of that all the animals and men and things. Yeah, you can only imagine the reek. Trying to disinfect it with a bit of vinegar. It's not really going to do anything, really, is it? We're told, quote, pets were ubiquitous, an inescapable fact of life at sea. Torridos, or shipworms, bored through the hole, slowly compromising the seaworthiness of the entire vessel, and one of Magellan's ships eventually disintegrated because of the wretched little creatures. Rats and mice infested every ship, and the sailors learned to live with them and even play with them. And when starvation became a true issue, catching a mouse or a rat in order to eat it was, you know, you'd resort to that very, very much so. Magellan's crew might have brought along a domestic creature new to Europe at the time, the cat, to hunt the rodents. Yeah, ship's cat. Yeah, that goes all the way up to the 19th century as well. It is recorded, however, that the men of the Armada de Molucca were plagued by all manner of lice, bedbugs, and cockroaches. When conditions turned hot and humid, the insects infested the clothing, the sails, the food supply, and even the rigging. The sailors scratched and complained that they had no defence against the pests. And remember, we're long before the age where they knew about the germ theory of disease. So they thought of them as an annoying pest, but didn't necessarily realise the danger of you know, disease and infection and all sorts of things that can introduce. They knew it was better to be clean, but they didn't necessarily realise how dangerous it could be. Because, as you can well imagine, if and when any infectious disease did break out on board ship, oh, that's terrible, because you're so crammed in, so living so close together that, yeah, something that's infectious will just spread through the whole crew, can and did. So that's another ever-present concern. Even worse, weevils invaded the hardtack, the lesser of two weevils, and it was further contaminated with the urine and feces of rodents. Crew members with growling stomachs forced themselves to overcome their inhibitions and swallow this disgusting contaminated food. Sailors found it nearly impossible to keep clean. Many brought along soap and a rag for washing, but the only available water, seawater, caused itching and irritation. The sailors washed their clothes in seawater as well, with limited results. To keep warm and dry, sailors wore baggy, loosely fitted clothes consisting of a floppy shirt, often with a hood, over which they wore a wooden pullover, which was cinched at the waist. Sailors were known everywhere for their floppy, pyjama-like pants, which reached below the knee. Depending on the rank of the sailor and the money at his disposal, they could be made from cheap coarse linen or fine wool with silk taffeta. In foul weather, sailors and officers alike donned great blue capes called capotes de la mer. It was a common sight to see a watchman huddled within his cape, with only his head exposed, peering across a storm-tossed deck for hours on end. We're going to be told of all different types of cap or hat which sailors wore, which I won't necessarily bore you with, other than to say that Magellan and lots of other people would take many, many caps or hats in order to trade them. There are various things that Europeans would trade with natives, indigenous peoples that they came across, that they considered of not much value or didn't actually cost much money back home, but which indigenous peoples valued highly. So you could trade something that you didn't really care about for some actual, like, silver or gold or you know, food, which was the difference between life and death. And one of those ones were these felt caps, these bonnets that they would have. Another one was beads. Beads in 16th century Spain were dirt cheap, but apparently most indigenous peoples loved them and would give you things of value in exchange for them. I then told a little bit more about the national makeup of Magellan's cruise. And this becomes really important because the next major event really is another mutiny, but this time a serious one. If you think about it, so far on this voyage, it hasn't been too bad, right? They've been storm-tossed and there has been an attempt, a kind of half-hearted, mild attempt at a mutiny. But they crossed the Atlantic without losing any ships, without losing anyone. There hasn't been a real mutiny. So far, nothing truly disastrous has happened to them, but all that is to change. And so we must talk about in a bit of detail the makeup of these crews. So we're told, quote, Magellan's crew was overwhelmingly Castilian and Portuguese, but representatives of every major country in Western Europe, as well as North Africa, Greece, Rhodes, and Sicily filled the ranks. Their number included alliances of natural enemies, Britons and Basques, Flemish and French, all speaking in mutually unintelligible tongues. The common language aboard Magellan's fleet was naturally Castilian, which contained specialised terms for every line, claw and device to be found aboard the ships. In this idiom, Magellan and his captains gave orders to the crew. We're told, the men quickly left behind the identities they had maintained on land for those imposed on them at sea. No longer did it matter if they were Castilians, Greeks, Portuguese or Genoese. Life aboard ship was lived according to a rigid social structure, segregating men who nonetheless lived in extremely close quarters and who depended on each other for their survival. A strict division of labour ruled over them. At the bottom were the pages, assigned to the ships in pairs. Many pages were mere children, as young as 8 years old. None were older than 15. They were commonly orphans. Not all pages were created equal. Some had been virtually kidnapped from the quays of Seville and pressed into service. If they had not been on ships, they would have been roaming the streets, learning to pick pockets and getting into minor scrapes. They were treated harshly, exploited shamelessly, deprived of adequate pay, and occasionally made the victims of sexual predators among older crew members. Their chores included scrubbing the decks with salt water hauled from the sea in buckets, serving and cleaning after meals, and performing any menial tasks assigned to them. Another class of page lived a very different life, privileged and relatively free of demand under the protection of officers. These hand-picked young men generally came from good, well-connected families and worked as apprentices for their protectors. They were expected to learn their trade and to rise through the ranks. Their duties were far lighter than those of the unfortunate boys who had been pressed into service. The privileged pages maintained the 16 Venetian sand clocks carried by Magellan ships, basically a large hourglass. The sand clock had been in use since Egyptian times. It was essential for good timekeeping and for navigation. The ampolitas, which was the name for these big sat hourglasses, consisted of a glass vessel divided into two compartments, the upper chamber containing a quantity of sand trickling into the lower over a precisely measured period of time, usually a half hour or an hour. Maintaining these was simple enough. The pages turned them over every half hour, night and day. Again, these things stayed up until the 19th century. But the task was critical. Aboard a swaying ship, these hourglasses were the only reliable timepiece, and the captain depended on them for dead reckoning and changing of watches. A ship without a functioning hourglass was effectively disabled, and the keeping of time was very important also for prayers. We're told a big bunch here all about the religious regime that ruled on board these ships, and it is extremely religious. Well, not for them, not in their world, it was just normal, but perhaps to our mind, is quite religious. You know, the keeping of mass. Sunday is very important, even if you're in the middle of the ocean, and particular saints' days and particular holidays were, you know, strictly observed. You know, Easter is still a massive, and Christmas, even more so Easter, was still a massive, massive thing, even if you're in the middle of the Pacific. So knowing which day it is, or what time of day it is for your prayers and all that sort of thing is still extremely important to them. We're told that, quote, just above the pages in rank came the apprentices, the most expendable and vulnerable members of all the crew, ranging in age from 17 to 20. They were the ones who sprang on the rigging the moment the captain ordered them to furl or unfurl the sail, to scamper to the dangerous lookout posts atop the masts, to pull on the oars in the longboat, and to operate the complex mechanical devices aboard ship, the pulleys and cranes, the cables and anchors, the fixed and movable rigging. They teamed up to operate the capstan, rotating its drum with levers to load or unload heavy supplies, weapons, and ballast. They even shaved the legs and manicured the toenails of their masters, perhaps setting the stage for sexual relations between the two, even though such behaviour was strictly forbidden. Apprentices were the group most likely to be disciplined and to be whipped for disobedience or to be confined to the stocks for as long as a week. So the thing we've mentioned here a couple of times now is sex on board the ship. And again, all the way up to the 19th century or later even, just like if you throw a bunch of men, crazy desperado type men, wild men, like in prison, you know, they might not even be, strictly speaking, homosexual, and yet shenanigans will occur. I did a bit of content recently with Luca all about Master and Commander, and even in that, which is a very quaint, very genteel novel, it still mentioned that, you know, younger, good-looking, weaker men will be taken advantage of, and even livestock, you know, a goat or a sheep on board might not be safe. It's horrible, but that's just the reality of it. But it was all strict, completely illegal and punishable, like sodomy in the 16th century or wherever in European culture was highly, highly frowned upon and illegal. You know, the punishment for that will be extreme. You might well be executed for it. And yet it sort of will go on, sort of almost can't be avoided. Well, there you have it. Bergerin continues. If an apprentice survived all the ordeals and hazards of life at sea, he could apply for certification as a sailor. That's like an actual, you know, that's a rank, just be a sailor. Receiving a document signed by the ship's pilot, boatswain, and master, he was now a professional mariner and could look forward to a career lasting about 20 years if he lived that long. Sailors advanced through the ranks by learning how to handle the helm, deploy the sounding line, splice cables, and if they were mathematically inclined, marking maps and taking measurements of celestial objects to fix the ship's position. Most sailors were in their teens or 20s. Anyone who had reached their 30s was considered a veteran scallywag. By the time he had survived to that age, he had seen what life at sea held: brutality, loneliness, and disease. He had experienced flashes of camaraderie and heroism, as well as a persistent dishonesty and callousness. He knew all about the avarice of ship owners, the uncomprehending indifference of kings under whose flag the expedition sailed, and the tyranny of captains. Many rarely went to sea beyond the age of 40. Magellan, nearly that age when he left Seville, was among the oldest, if not the oldest person aboard the Armada de Maluca, end quote. So yeah, a thing to say, it's a hard life. I mean, obviously, it's a really hard life. So older men just don't really do it hardly often, unless you're extremely senior. You don't really have to do any hard work. Somebody like the captain or a pilot, maybe then. But if you're just a normal sailor who's supposed to be doing extremely physically difficult things kind of constantly and living more or less outdoors, a lot of your time will be spent on deck and therefore open to the elements. So that's a hard life, particularly, you know, we're talking about the 16th century still, 50-year-olds and up. It's not for you. It's just not for you. It's as simple as that. It's like, I don't know, I think of it like boxing or MMA. You might be up for it, but your body's not going to be able to do it. You just simply physically are not going to be able to do it. Even if, you know, you've got the will, it's a young man's game. No matter how high an ordinary sailor rose, he was outranked by specialists such as gunners, essential to expeditions exploring new lands, but hard to come by. Skilled in the use of cannon, in the preparation of gunpowder, and the selection of projectiles, the gunner tended to his weapons throughout the voyage, keeping them secure, clean, free of rust, and ready for battle at all times. Like, literally at the drop of a hat, it might be, we need to fire a cannon, like right now. We needed to fire it like 2 minutes ago. So it is really sort of at all times. Although most gunners were Flemings, Germans, or Italians, the Casa de Contratación kept a gunnery contractor on its staff to train Castilians. The Casa provided the cannon, but the gunners in training had to pay the instructor's fees, as well as the cost of gunpowder, which was enough to discourage many potential students. That's an interesting, isn't it? That's an interesting idea, that the gunners themselves have to pay for the gunpowder. You know, right there you can see, so the poorest of the poor, you know, a street urchin hoping to get aboard a ship, they got no chance of being a gunner. Less glamorous but equally necessary fields of specialisation included carpenters, absolutely vital. So there's sort of constant repairs going on. Ship's carpenter, absolutely vital. Caulkers and coopers. This last group, coopers, you know, barrels, making and maintaining barrels. This last group repaired the hundreds of casks and buckets aboard the ship by replacing hoops or staves and sealing leaks. There was also a complement of divers aboard the ship, whose job it was to swim under the ship when necessary, clear seaweed from the rudder and keel, and inspect the hull for signs of exterior damage and leaks. The ship's barber, another specialist, was deceptively named because trimming beards was the least of his responsibilities. He served as the onboard dentist, doctor, and surgeon, ministering to the crew out of his chest of nostrums, herbs, and folk remedies. The fleet's barber was named Hernando Bustamante, who shipped out aboard Conception. Records show that his medical supplies were purchased from the apothecary named John Vernal on July the 19th, 1519, shortly before departure. Included were distillations of various herbs, among them fennel, thistle, and chicory, a purgative, turpentine, lard, various unguents and oils, 6 pounds of cameline, honey, incense, and quicksilver, all of them carefully stored in canisters. Bustamante also carried an assortment of tools with him. Medical chests of the era contained a brass mortar and pestle to grind compounds, and a selection of surgical instruments, including scissors, a lancet, a tooth extractor, an enema syringe made from copper, and a scale. This slender store of medical supplies and equipment would have to serve the needs of 260 men of the fleet in all climates and conditions for several years. In practice, Bustamante's most frequent duty at sea was extracting teeth, not treating disease. So that's a thing to mention. I must have said it a number of times on EPA, worth saying again here, that in the age before modern dentistry, your teeth caused you endless trouble. At a certain point in your life, as you get older, your teeth basically just start to rot out of your head. There's no other way around it. Now, we live in a world where all sorts of things can be done to slow that down. And if and when it happens, all sorts of various things that can be done for you. In their world, you just put up with it or had them yanked out. There's no anaesthetic other than maybe a nip of liquor, you know, some sort of whiskey or something to help with the pain a little bit. Essentially, the barber will just come in with a pair of pliers or something similar and just yank the tooth out, and that's it. And, you know, the hole in your gum may or may not get infected, and, you know, quite possibly would. And abscesses, if you've ever had an abscess, you know that that is no laughing matter. Not much that can be done about it, really. You can try and lance it. If it gets so filled with pus, you can lance it a bit, but then, you know, that's not great. That might also then get infected. Once again, they had no idea of the germ theory of disease, so the utensils being used probably, or almost certainly, won't be clean. certainly won't be properly sterile. So everyone suffers from their teeth, whether you're at sea or not. So at sea, you're always worried about your teeth. I mean, if you ever see the film Cast Away with Tom Hanks, if you ever find yourself in a situation where you're away from civilization, you should be worried about your teeth. The last thing you want is to wake up with a toothache, because it's not going to end nicely for you one way or another. Berggren goes on saying, no one answered to the description of cook aboard these ships because the job was considered too demeaning. One sailor telling another that his beard smelled of smoke was tantamount to provoking a fight. So the crew took turns cooking or paid the apprentices to cook for them. And during foul weather, there was no cooking at all, and the sailors endured cold repasts and hardtack, salted meat and wine. In addition to these traditional roles, the Armada's roster included phantom crew members, saints who, by custom of the sea, found their way into the ship's rosters. Magellan's fleet included Santo Adelmo, the patron saint of Burgos, Santo Antonio de Lisboa, the popular patron saint of Lisbon, who was reputed to rescue shipwrecked sailors and provide favourable winds to their ships, Santa Barbara, whom Spaniards invoked as a safeguard against violent storms, and Nuestra Senora de Monstrat, to whom a famous Benedictine shrine was dedicated. Even more remarkable, each of these ghostly personages was accorded a share of the fleet's profit in return for divine protection. The arrangement was a clever way of donating a portion of the expedition's profits to the church. Officers ranked just above the sailors and specialists in the fleet's hierarchy. One tier consisted of the steward, charged with keeping an eye on the food supplier, the boatswain's mate, and the alguacil. The alguacil, for which there is no exact translation, served as the king's representative aboard the ship and served as a master at arms or military officer. If Magellan needed to arrest a crew member, he ordered the alguacil to perform the deed. This was not a job designed to endear him to the other crew members, and the alguacil stood apart from the rest of the crew. At the top of the pinnacle came the pilot, who plotted the ship's route, the master, who supervised the precious cargo, and finally the captain. Each of the top three officers had his own page. As captain general, Magellan had several, including his illegitimate son, and they lived a life as separate as possible from the rank and file sailors and apprentices. The officers had their own cabins, cramped to be sure, but a mark of distinction, and they rarely ate with the crew. To most of the men aboard the ships, even the flagship, Trinidad, Ferdinand Magellan seemed a remote, imperious figure, authoritarian and arbitrary, a man whose every word was law and on whose skill, luck and good judgment their lives depended. So the thing to say, perhaps it's obvious if you know anything about this sort of thing, but maybe not. The captain's word is law at sea. If he says jump, you jump. If he says this man is to be executed or something, then he's going to be executed. It really is sort of, there's no appeal, there's no higher appeal or anything. A bit like in a Roman army camp, the general in a Roman army, all other law, all other sort of civil law is just completely ignored. His word is law. And so that's what it was like aboard these ships. And so you can only imagine the reality of that is that you live in fear of them. Even if they are quite kindly, even if they weren't that authoritarian, you would still be in awe of them and scared of them and all those sorts of things. They live a life apart. And so it does depend on the individual characters of the captains and the senior officers. You know, if they're nice and kindly and generous, then that's one thing. And if they're cruel and unusual, then that's what it is. That's how it goes. So you sort of hope, you would always hope if you're a normal crew member, that your captain isn't a tyrant. Even though he might be forced to act as one sometimes, even against his own better judgment. If you do get like a Captain Bligh type figure, you know, an absolute martinet, then, you know, a taskmaster, then, well, you've just got to live with that. So what was Magellan like? Well, Magellan was a bit more on the end of the spectrum of being a hard-ass taskmaster. No one really thinks he's sort of cruel and unusual. He's more towards that end of the spectrum than being kindly and generous of spirit. So we're told a little bit about him. Although sea captains, Magellan included, could be notoriously high-handed, the sailor's lot was governed, at least in theory, by the Consulado de Mer, the Spanish maritime code that had been in existence and in force for several centuries before it was formally compiled in 1494. The code described approved methods for hiring and paying sailors and spelled out the ordinary seamen's exhausting chores, as well as the punishments, which by our standard would seem extremely draconian. You know, for example, they had one rule that when you're at sea, you just don't undress at any point. You just keep wearing your clothes until they rot off of you or something. You're just not to get undressed for any reason. And if you do, you're punished. You're to be plunged into the sea with a rope. And if you're caught doing it three times, you're to lose your salary. If you enjoyed that preview, please consider heading over to lotuseaters.com to watch the full unabridged video.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.